This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange.
This is Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, and I'm at Strange Harbor. And this is where you need to be. Keep listening, because it's happening right here.
This pilot, though, who flew Barack Obama during his 2008 presidential campaign, says UFOs are real, and he's seen one firsthand. An unidentified object seen over the sky above the Rosedale area.
The shot today video that's got all of Texas talking, probably the whole country, from iReporter, who shot this on a cell phone near Stephenville, Texas. The UFO, according to witnesses, and the witnesses include local police and other public figures.
When several dozen residents looked up and saw a UFO more than once.
Three very mysterious shiny lights over Breckenridge have police and residents puzzled.
Tonight we have never before seen videotape of UFOs over Colorado.
If you noticed strange lights in the sky over the weekend, you aren't alone. KCTV5's Alan Schoaf went to Lee's Summit to get to the bottom of more than a dozen UFO sightings.
Never before seen footage of UFO sightings this year being shown at a conference in Pontefract.
Local police never definitively said who's to blame. Locals say it has to be something out of this world.
I'm taking a random picture, zoomed in, and there was a UFO.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange.
Hey, this is Derek Randles with the Olympic Project, and you're listening to Strange Harbor.
Don't miss a single episode because strange things are going to happen.
This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. We talk about UFOs, alien abduction, near-death experience, Sasquatch, and so much more. I am Johnny Manson, and she is MUFON investigator Sherita Seuss.
Keeping it real with UFOs.
And our guest today, Mark Musick. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Now, you were in the military, right?
I'm a retired major general. I was in the Air Force and was in active duty on the Air Force from 72 through 1980. And then left the Air Force, joined the Air National Guard in Nebraska, and was in that, became the commander for the Air National Guard in Nebraska, and then the assistant adjutant general for Air in Nebraska. And then the final position was with a two-star position with STATCOM at Offutt. But the amazing thing that we're going to talk about today is a story. I met a lady in 2002, and she started telling me this story, and I thought, this is just weirdness, this is craziness, this is can't possibly be true. And the story was that she was married to Howard Hughes, and that Howard Hughes had just died in 2001. And when she first told me the story, I thought, her name was Eva McClellan. I thought, Eva, you are loony. You are just loony. And I said, Eva, Howard Hughes died 25 years ago. And she said, that's what they want you to think. And she started in on the story. And honestly, I didn't believe her for 4 years. I thought, this can't be true. But during those 4 years, I went back and started to research things, started to go back and get military records, medical records. And lo and behold, what I deduced and came to the conclusion was everything she said was true.
Wow. This is such a huge story. The fact that it hasn't been blasted on every news channel, etc., is just amazing to me. You wrote that there were two distinct Howards. There was an articulate Howard Hughes talking to journalists, and then a month later, there was this emaciated, long-fingernailed Howard Hughes taken to Nicaragua. And then March, a commanding Howard Hughes visits with the president of Nicaragua. So can you flesh that out a little bit for us and tell us what was going on there?
Oh, Cherie, this is the wildness here associated with it. There's just confusion upon confusion. And Howard at this point in time in the early 70s was described as this long-haired, long-fingered, drug-addicted, bedridden, 90-pound, mentally incompetent man. That's what he's described as. However, between 72 and 73, there was many strange things going on because Howard would in January 72, Howard was on a radio, on a telephonic interview with six journalists out of Los Angeles, and he was described as a commanding, charming, healthy man. But then 6 weeks after that, Howard Hughes was taken from the Bahamas to Nicaragua in a boat, and the captain of the boat saw him as this long-haired, long-fingernailed, drug-addicted, bedridden guy with a raincoat wrapped around him with a hat pulled over his head.
Huh.
And then shortly after that, in March of 72, he was met with the president of Nicaragua, again, a commanding, charming, healthy man. And so this goes on for almost 2 years.
Wow.
Between this long-haired, long-fingernailed, 100-pound, drug-addicted, bedridden man and a charming man who would have meetings with the governor of Nevada, who flew airplanes in England in 73, who met with Merrill Lynch people to sell parts of his company in September 72. There's just massive, massive confusion in there of what's going on, to the point that the public can't figure it out. You can't tell what's going on.
Huh.
And then it becomes clear when Eva McClellan comes forward with the story of what they did. They had a stand-in. There's a stand-in for him who was the drug-addicted, bedridden, 90-pound, mentally incompetent man. And Howard continued to do business as he went through those years, very secretive, very undercover.
I'm not sure who they are. Why don't you explain who they are?
Okay, they, if you throw what is really helping him do this, if you look at that a little bit, in 1968, there was a Soviet sub that sank in the northwest of Hawaii, about 750 miles northwest of Hawaii. And the CIA wanted that sub raised. And who did they go to raise the sub? Howard Hughes. And what did he say? He built the Glomar Explorer and he raised it. Well, what we believe, this is our speculation, he said, I'll go raise that submarine, CIA. You get me another identity. And the identity that he gave him was a man who was associated with the CIA, who just disappeared in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
He was living, his man named Werner Nicely. He was living in Panama. Family left him about 65, 67. Family leaves him. And so he's all alone down there working counter drugs in Colombia.
Huh.
And this guy, Werner Nicely, just disappears. We don't know what happened to him. And now Howard Hughes, in November of 69, shows up in Panama as this guy. Well, Werner Nicely's height was 5'11". We have all of his military records and so forth. 5'11". The man now that's Werner Nicely is now 6'4", 6'3", a tall man.
Uh-huh.
But he calls himself Nick Nicely. He throws more confusion into the situation. So he picks another name, calls himself Nick Nicely, and that's who Eva meets in November 1969 in Panama. Is this Nick Nicely guy, 6'3", handsome man, aides around him, always doing business, would just disappear for months at a time, would just disappear. And that's who Eva got to know and was engaged in March of 70, married in May of 70. And then she knew there was weirdness and strangeness about this man, but knew when to quit asking questions and knew when to just keep to herself. And then she realized it about 3 years later, I'm married to Howard Hughes under this other identity.
You alluded that there was an important reason that Howard Hughes wanted a new identity. What was that?
Well, that's a good question. Howard Hughes was just a very, very reclusive man. He did not like being in the public. He did not like being in front of people and things like that. His last picture was taken in 1954, and he just liked to hide, and he pretty much hid from there on out from the public, that they didn't really know what he was doing. But he kept in charge of his business all this time, and he was many specific things associated with the CIA. For instance, he put up their first communication satellites. Therefore, he could communicate using the CIA's communication satellites. You remember that telephonic interview that happened in January 72? They tried to trace it. They could never trace it. Well, it becomes very clear what he was doing. He was using their satellites. Nobody could trace them.
Uh-huh.
And he just kept everything he was able to keep under the visibility, or throw enough confusion into it that no one really knew what the truth was.
I understand that he was an elusive man and liked his privacy, but his money, would have guaranteed that privacy. I'm thinking that there's something else here, too. Was it perhaps that he was not in favor with the public?
I don't know. He was kind of a hero with the public at this point in time. Because he, in the 30s, he had done a lot in aviation. He flew a little H-1 racer that he had built across the United States, setting the land speed record across the United States. That was in 37. Mm-hmm. In 38, he flew around the world in a little bit over 3 days. And so he had a lot of visibility with the public. I don't think it just matched his personality, though. And then, of course, he built these Spruce Goose. He didn't like that name. Built the Hercules,
right,
which he flew in 47. In November 47, he flew that for about a mile, about 70 feet in altitude, and showed that would fly, the biggest plane ever built in the world. But he just didn't like, and the guy was a germaphobe, too. He was very much a germaphobe, afraid of germs and things like that. If he grew up during the pandemic in 1917-1918.
Ah.
And his mother was very much a germaphobe, which brought him into the picture of, you know, being clean and always washing hands and being careful what you eat and all of that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
So he had a lot of phobias that he was dealing with in his life. But he was the richest man in America. Possibly the richest man in the world,
mm-hmm,
but for sure the richest man in America. And so he could buy anything he wanted to buy. And he had the government behind him, the CIA was behind him, and so a very secretive agency there. So he could hide with all of his support. And now, beginning in 1970, he's got a woman that loves him, and he loves her. This is really a love story. They both love each other. They're married. And she keeps the secret. She realizes that she has to keep the secret,
right,
until his final passing,
right,
which was November 2001. I met her January 2002, and she told me the story. And I don't know why I was the lucky one that she told the story to, but somehow I ended up with it. I think she liked my military background.
The man is the wealthiest man in the world, but he can't take it with him with his new identity. That money has to stay in limbo, basically, because he's taken on this new identity.
Oh, Cherie, that's really good. That's really good. When Howard Hughes supposedly died, and this was the stand-in that died in 76, the long-haired, long-finger, drug-addicted, 90-pound bedridden guy, he's the one who died in 76, that started the Who's Got the Will for Howard Hughes.
Uh-huh.
And 30 people came forward, said, well, I've got the will for Howard Hughes. And the courts ruled none of them were legit. And at this point, the books say Howard was worth $2.2 billion. Now, that was quite a bit of money in 1976. And so the fight now starts on what happens to all this money. And they fought over that for decades. They fought over that for decades. Meanwhile, Howard is living under this other identity. And people say, why on earth would the richest man in America give away all of his money? That's a very good question, because he didn't. I asked Eva, did he have access to money? And she said, yes, he had a checking account. He had a Chase Manhattan checking account, which he could write a check on, and he had access to money whenever he wanted it.
Sure.
And so in essence, he did not give away his total wealth. He still had access to money.
So he really,
as he needed it. She never saw it.
Right.
You know, she never saw the money, but he had access to it when he wanted to buy something.
Right. Because I work for MUFON, I have access to stories about Howard Hughes, and he was related to the Roswell case. Did you know that?
No, go into that a little bit more, please.
He was actually tapped to help investigate the leftover craft because of all of his flying experience and how brilliant he was. And it left a mark with him. The story goes that he was overwhelmed by the Roswell incident, but he was still working with, at that time, probably the FBI and Blue Book or whomever in that time. But they did tap him. The government tapped him to check out Roswell. That's something I wondered if, because he put up the communication satellites, because he, you know, lifted a submarine. He was so brilliant that just seems to play right for me.
Now, that's interesting. I've had multiple people give me information. I know no direct information on this, but I've had some people who have talked to me about this. And one of them said that he would fly with Howard directly into Area 51.
Yeah.
And this would have been in the late 70s, early 80s, direct in Area 51. And I said, what did you do there? And he said, they were working on some stealth technology aircraft, which would have been a stealth fighter and a stealth bomber. And that's what they went and looked at. And I said, do you have any information on other places, any of these reports of alien aircraft or things like that in Area 51? And he said, no, I don't. But he said that Howard was just enthralled with that stuff. And interesting enough, there's a facility in Southern California, I think near 29 Palms, called the Integratron. And that, as my understanding, Howard uses money and Nikola Tesla's technology to expand communication, let's say, outside of our universe.
Right.
And so there has been, there's evidently some connection between Nikola Tesla's, you know, capabilities and technology and Howard Hughes' interest in this area of reaching out outside of our universe.
Right, right. That's a fascinating part of Howard Hughes' life that, you know, unless somebody digs for that, we probably won't know the full story. But it's fascinating. One of the things that you talk about Ava McClelland and Howard Hughes is that they lived out of boxes. I would imagine that was because they were moving around a lot.
Yes. When Ava started talking to me about this story, and I just started investigating it to see, can I find anything that supports your story at all on this? And when I first met her, she was just living out of boxes because they needed to move quickly. And he really wouldn't let her unpack. Where I met her in her apartment, she had boxes stacked all around the apartment. And when we finally got to the point of documenting this down and putting a book out on it, Eva said, I'd like it to be named Boxes because that's how we lived. We had to be able to move. We had to be able to leave very, very quickly. And it's interesting, they lived on this wooded acreage west of Troy, Alabama. It's about 20 acres of wooded property west of Troy, Alabama. And I took Eva there several times. And on this property, there were some barrels, you know, like Rubbermaid trash barrels.
Sure.
And I said, Eva, why are those barrels out there? And she laughed and said, oh, that's where Nick kept his clothes. And I thought, what? And she said, yeah, he kept his clothes in there. And so I went in and opened them up and took the top off, and sure enough, there was laundered pants and shirts and things in the bottom of them.
Right.
And I said, Eva, why would this be? And he said, he had to be able to leave at a minute's notice. And so they could bring a pickup truck in, there could be a pickup truck brought in, throw him in the front of it, throw these five barrels in the back, and he could be gone in minutes.
Wow.
And that's how she lived. That's how she lived with him. He could be gone in minutes.
And he would take off himself. He would go off on these month-long or even longer excursions and then come back.
That is correct. Both he would leave. He'd just disappear. And she would disappear because he was hard. She wouldn't disappear. She'd just leave him because he was hard to live with. He was... His personality would change very, very quickly from a very, very charming man to a very verbally vicious man. And so she got tired of putting up with that, and so she'd leave. And she'd leave for 9 months or 6 months at a time, but they always got back together again. And then he would just disappear. She didn't know where he was. He would just disappear. When they met in November of 69, in November 70, in December 69 and January 70, he was gone. He came back in February 70 into Panama, and they got back together again because they kind of enjoyed each other's company.
Right.
And she asked him, well, Nick, where have you been? And he said, well, I had some business to attend to in the States. Eva said, well, while you were gone, I felt like I was being followed. And he said, you were being followed. We checked out everything about you.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't think that'd leave you in a very comfortable state if someone just told you, we checked everything about you, and you've only known him for about, you know, for about 4 weeks.
But then he married her in 1970.
Married her, yeah, married her. They went to the nicest jewelry store in Panama in March of 70. He bought her a diamond ring, and so now they're engaged. And soon after that, he said, I need you to sign everything for me. But instead of Nick Nicolay, she knew him as Nick Nicolay, he now brings out this Werner Nicely identity. And so she practices Werner Nicely, Werner Nicely, Werner Nicely. And he finally says, it's good enough. And there for the next 31 years, she signed everything. He would never sign anything. She signed everything for him that needed to be signed. And then they were married in May of 70. And all this time, Eve is putting together these little bits and pieces of the puzzle of who is this guy? How can he have these aides around him all the time?
Oh.
You know, who is he? And then she figures it out.
It's not like he could change his face, even with, you know, a beard or mustache or changing his hair color. The structure of his face was there. And she was a beautiful woman that looked very much like Elizabeth Taylor.
She was very, very pretty. And, of course, Howard loved Elizabeth Taylor. In 1947, Howard went to Elizabeth Taylor's mother and said, I will pay you $1 million if you let me marry Elizabeth. And when Elizabeth heard it, she just got a big laugh out of it. Of course, that never went anywhere. But he loved Elizabeth. And Eva was a pretty woman. She somewhat resembled Elizabeth Taylor, which would be the physical, you know, attraction between the two.
More with retired Major General and author of the book Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. We're talking with Mark Musick, coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird. Our guest, retired Major General Mark Musick, author of the book Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. You can get more info, boxeshowardhughessecrets.com.
His life was full of mystery. He had literally his hand into everything.
The guy who had multiple talents, Eva called him a genius. He was an absolute genius. And the people who knew him, there's some neighbors who interacted with him and things like that, also said the guy was a genius. And he got his money, of course, from his dad, was in the oil business and invented this drill bit that has three counter-rotating heads and it goes through rock. And that's about all my knowledge of the drill bit. But at that point, it was huge in the oil industry. And evidently, the concept still is there in the oil industry.
Huh.
And so his dad invented that. His dad then died when he was when Howard was 19. So his dad died when he was very, very young. And that's when Howard moved into the movie business, made many, many movies.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned on the movie business is the more he stayed out of the movies, the more successful that it was.
Yeah.
The more he got involved with it, the less successful that it was.
Huh.
But he liked movies. And then he got into aircraft in the 30s, designing aircraft, flying aircraft, doing all of that type of thing with aircraft. In the 30s, And so then he got into equipment, military-related equipment, helicopters, you know, all kind of different airplanes and things like that. One other interesting thing is that he had an aircraft accident in 1946. He had an aircraft accident, burned about probably more than 50% of his body, but his hands were damaged and his feet were damaged in that aircraft accident.
Huh.
And, of course, this guy, Nickley, or Werner Nicely, also his hands were damaged and his feet were damaged. As Evo recalled it back, and then and as other people met him, the same comments were made on that, that his hands and feet had been in some kind of an accident, a fairly significant accident, and it was still noticeable well up as he aged.
Okay.
Eva said he always wore gloves.
Yeah.
He always wore gloves because of, I think, several reasons. One, his hands were very, very tender from this damage.
Sure.
And he didn't want to wear he didn't want to leave fingerprints wherever he went. And then he's also a germaphobe.
Right, right.
And so, so Eva said he would wear gloves pretty much all the time, probably for any of those three reasons. They were all good reasons to be wearing gloves.
Huh. Well, that's one of his quirks.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm very fascinated with your own career. I mean, you were a major general. Okay, that's huge. You were in the Air Force. Again, I'm, you know, someone who works with MUFON. I want to know if you've had any kind of UFO experience or, I mean, you talked about Offutt. You talked about being in Nebraska. Do you have any stories to tell?
You know, I do not. I do not have any personal stories in that at all. I've known a couple people who have had some unusual things happen, but personally, I have not had any UFO experiences or interaction at all. Sorry to say that, but that's the case.
Were you ever aware of the Minuteman missile silos being shut down by what was known back then in the 1966 time as, you know, UFOs?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Huh.
The only story that I know is there was a pilot that I knew that was on a low level. We used to fly low levels in the F-4, long obsolete plane. But fly low level in the F-4, and all of a sudden there's a light in front of him, and he tried to find out what it is and push the power up and catch it, and the F-4 goes pretty fast, but this thing just took off and went much faster than the F-4 could ever go, and just, you know, disappeared.
Interesting.
And so that's really the only story that I've heard of it. Other than in World War II, they had the Foo Fighters. During World War II, the orbs of light that were there on both sides, both in the Allied side and the German side, these orbs of light would fly in formation with the aircraft. And
yeah.
That was both sides experienced it. Most time the crews never reported it because they were afraid somebody would think they're just loony.
Right. They take away their privilege to fly.
There's pictures of them and things like that, so it's pretty... a lot of evidence for it not to have happened.
Your book, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, there are two authors. There's yourself, Mark Muzik, and also Douglas Wellman. What's his story?
Okay, Douglas Wellman, when I was putting this book together, I met her in 2002, and I started documenting it down about 2006 after I concluded that, well, I think it's real. Started documenting it down, and it became so, it's got about four storylines in it that's all intertwined. And so I put all those four storylines together, but I needed some help in integrating the four storylines, and so it could become into a unified story. And I was having problems doing that. And so I knew a gentleman in the military, Lieutenant Colonel, actually, at that point in time, that I trusted very, very well. And I asked him, I told him what I was doing, and I said, I'm looking for someone to maybe help me with this. And he said, I might know a gentleman. And so he linked us up. And Douglas Wellman was also an author, and he was a producer and director of some TV shows and things like that. And so met with him, and he had written a book about Howard Hughes. And so he knew a little bit about the man. And so I went with Doug and met him for 2 hours at his house and talked about the story.
Oh.
And he looked at me respectfully with a lot of doubt in his mind and his face and his voice. The last hour that we spent, I showed him, I took the documentation that I had, you know, all put together, the manuscript that I had, all of the backup that I had associated with it. And he said, let's meet in the morning. And so he went and looked at it, and we met the next morning, and he said, I understand you're looking for somebody to help you write this. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, I'll do it. Later on, I said, Doug, why did you agree to do this thing? And he said, because of the documentation. He said, you had so much documentation on this backing the story up that, you know, it basically had to be true. That's when he decided, I'm going to go do it. And then we worked together on it. Then I read the book 3 times to Eva, because Eva wanted no Hollywood in this book. She wanted everything true. And so I read the book to her, and if I would have made a mistake in it, she pointed out very, very quickly that this is not right. You need to fix this. And then Doug and I went and spent a day with her. Doug actually tried to trick her on something. Could she, you know, what's your story now if I try to get her off of what she's saying? The issue becomes she always went back to her story. She never, ever modified her story.
She didn't waver.
And never wavered. Nothing ever changed in her story. Dates, facts. I'd even go back and talk about conversations that she had with her husband. And she would even go back to the same exact words that he had used, never even varying in the exact words that he used. And she wanted to make sure that everything was accurate in the story. And so we made it as accurate as we could possibly make it.
Do you know if Howard Hughes was taking any kind of drugs? I'm not talking about illicit drugs. I'm talking about drugs by, you know, a doctor.
Okay, two aspects here on that. That's a very good question. Two aspects here on that. The man who was the stand-in, the best story we have on that is that was a man who Howard knew. It was an acquaintance who Howard knew, who was 20 years older than Howard, who was a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And they provided drugs for him for the rest of his life, from about 1969 to 1976, drugs were provided to him.
Uh-huh.
That he was a drug addict, and then he died of natural causes in 1976. Howard was on some medication, mostly codeine, for pain from his accident that he had in 1946. And Eva said that he was on massive amounts of over-the-counter drugs to delay that pain. And then also we found out that his hands and things, he was receiving, this was in the 80s now, he was receiving medication from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute for his hands, and salve for his hands and things like that, that were very tender and very sore from the aircraft accident. And so in the 80s, we've got confirmed with people who picked up their mail that he was getting medication from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. But, they like this story of always is on these drugs and drugs and drugs and drugs. That was not true. There was nothing true about that at all. The stand-in, yes, that was true of the stand-in.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that a man like Howard Hughes would use something that would change his ability to reason and to be clear-headed. I think he had a lot to do until the day he died. And I would love to know what kinds of projects he was doing, because that was the time from when he, you know, had a new identity for extraterrestrial, UFO, wanting to reverse engineer maybe something. I mean, he would be the ideal person to do that.
It is interesting. Contacts made with him I asked Eva, I said, Eva, do you know, did people come visit him? This was after 1976, you know, when they're out in this woods here in Alabama. And she said, oh, yes, he'd get visitors. People would come visit him. And I asked, well, how did that work? And she said, well, he would send out a postcard. And I asked Eva, I said, Eva, do you know what the postcard said? No. Do you know where they went? No. But I knew they were going out. And she said, shortly after the postcard went out, someone would come visit him. And one point, she said, I was out in this wooded area in Alabama, and there's a helicopter that flies over. She took a picture of it. And she waved at the helicopter. They waved back at her. And she took a picture of it. And this is one of the things that Doug Wellman and I talked to her about when we visited her. And so I came back home. I had all of her pictures. I came back home, went through all of her pictures, and most of them were nature pictures of trees and changing colors and flowers and things like that. But there was one picture in there of the helicopter, and I think we've got it in the book, actually, picture in the book. But there's a place that was about a quarter of a mile to the south of their ranch, he would call it, that was an open area, of which the helicopter would land and make contact with him. So he was in contact with people well after he was supposedly dead. So there was a number of people who knew that he was still alive, yes.
Interesting. This is quite an effort you've done. I know I'm going to be reading the book. I'm very interested in Howard Hughes and what he's done for our country and the world. So this is going to be a real piece of work. How many pages is it?
Oh, I think it's 320-some, something
Perfect.
Like that. Yeah, you kind of have to take what you've heard of Howard. Well, most people who's under about 65 or 70, they have a problem even relating to this story because they don't know, they don't know who the guy is. And so you got to kind of throw away everything that you thought you knew about Howard Hughes and just throw away because it's just, most of it just absolutely not true.
Oh.
And then you clear your mind of what you've been told, and then you can read the book and say, "Oh, this makes sense." The best thing, we don't have the proof. I wish we had the DNA proof, but we don't. Let's just face it, we don't have it. But if you read the book and put it all together, probably one of the best reviews I've gotten is, you know, it's easier to believe than to not to believe.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where this story is. It's easier to believe the story than not to believe the story, especially when you put all this evidence together and everything begins to fit into a picture of a man who hid away. The government helped him. He was rich. He had a woman that loved him, that helped him hide away. And you've now got a new angle of history that wasn't told with the original stories.
I have a question. Being, you know, a scientist myself, when you say you have no DNA proof, what happened to Howard Hughes' body when he did die?
Well, that's interesting. Howard Hughes, the real Howard Hughes, who died in 2002, was cremated.
Oh.
He was cremated. And I worked with a DNA expert for about 5 years on trying to get, you know, Nick or Vernon Ice's DNA, and we could never do it. We could never get it. The only DNA that we do have are children.
Right.
Now, Howard supposedly never had any children. That's not true either.
Uh-huh.
There's two in the book. There's a daughter, Cindy. There's a son named John. And they came forward to us, and, you know, we listened to their story skeptically to try to figure out, well, what's all this about you and your situation with Howard? And so we listened to their stories. It somewhat began to make sense. And Howard actually interacted with all of these children as they grew up. So he knew he had some biological children. Well, if you have a common parent, you have a 50% match of your DNA.
Right.
And, of course, Cindy and John, after we did their DNA, they agreed to it. We looked at it. We got the 50% match there. And there's been other children come forward now, too, who also have the 50% match.
Really?
And so the theory that Howard had no children really isn't true either. There's at least two and more.
Interesting. I wonder if any of them have their father's genius, brilliance.
I can't address that. Some of them are very, very smart. They're very, very smart people. There's one in the book, John. We have a picture of John in the book. John was born in 1942. And if you look at a picture of John right next to a picture of Howard, you've almost got an exact match.
Oh, there
they're in the book. you've almost got, and you can't tell them apart.
Interesting.
You cannot tell them apart. And then if you read through John's story and understand John's story, it begins to all make sense of Howard's interaction with his children, with all of his children, of which they've all had interactions with him. So he knew they existed.
Did he financially compensate them?
No. No, we don't find anything at all that he financially helped his children in any way, shape, or form, which is kind of disgusting to me. And he really never did anything for Eva either to financially help her. This is my plan. When I die, I'm going to go to heaven and say hello to Jesus, and then I'm going to go find Howard, and I'm going to wear my combat boots, which I still have. I'm going to wear my combat boots, and I'm going to kick him in the butt because he never cared. He never took care of his children. Richest man in America left his children without any financial support from himself.
Well, can't they, with their DNA, claim part of his fortune?
Well, that will was contested for, I think, about 35 years, and one of them actually tried to do that, and she was never was successful at it. Her paperwork was always lost. Her paperwork was always removed from her. It was never, ever allowed into any sort of a court hearing or any discussion that he might have had children. That's a sad, sad situation for the children.
That sounds like government dallying with the law.
Somebody's hiding something.
Yeah. There's a lot going on there. Are you going to write another book?
Since this book, we put the first book out in 2010, and that was our first edition book, and then we got information, and so we added more information, and the second edition was put out in 2016.
Uh-huh.
And since then, we've gotten quite a bit of more information, so there will be some more information come out on this. It's the date becomes the question of when's it going to happen? And we're not ready at this point to do that. But there's more information that just keeps coming out all the time. I did a radio interview, and a gentleman called me up about 4 weeks ago, and he said, I heard you on the radio. He said, I had an experience with Howard Hughes. This was 1978, 2 years after Howard died, 1978, and he ordered Howard's people, and they were having some meetings in there and so forth. And so these things just keep coming up, just reconfirming, that Howard didn't die in 76.
It's just amazing that no one said to this man that you met that he should never talk about the fact that it was Howard Hughes, or was Howard Hughes using another name?
He was, when he met these people, he was working actually as a janitor in this warehouse. And met these people, and he said their names were Howard and so forth. Howard, Bob, Jack, and Gordon. That's who he knew them as, those first names, because he ran into them multiple times in this thing. And then he figured out what was really going on, that this was Howard Hughes. I mean, he could tell by the by the look of him and everything like that. And then one day in 87, Howard was leaving, and he said, it's 5 o'clock in the evening or 5:30 in the air, and Howard was leaving this facility, and he said, have a good evening, Mr. Hughes. And at that point, Mr. Hughes just looked around, just stared at me. He said he just stared at me for 2 minutes, solid 2 minutes. Never said a word, turned around and had left.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he wasn't expecting anyone to address him that directly, I don't think. But then, as we figured out, Bob and Jack and Gordon, those were all Howard Hughes' people who he was dealing with after he was dead, after he was supposedly dead anyway.
Well, you've really gone down the rabbit hole, and you've pulled me in. I want to thank you so much for being on the show and sharing all this information.
It's just wild. It's just a wild, wild story. Like I said, it took me 4 years to believe it. I thought she was crazy. But then after I started putting the pieces together, there's nothing inaccurate about any of it. It just, the story just keeps growing and growing. What I have learned on this is that people come forward, people don't tend to make anything up. They just tell exactly what they experienced or what they live. And so it becomes very clear of, once you get over this, of is this true or not, it becomes very clear of, okay, this could very well have happened, and if these people come forward and give us enough information, it's probably all true.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you'd like to know more about Mr. Musick, his book Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, if you want to check out the latest UFO reports, Sasquatch sightings, or if you want to contact us and yell at us for being tinfoil hat wearing whack jobs, just log on to strangeharbor.net.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.